welcome to The More You Look, your behind-the-scenes journey into museum collections, research, exhibition, and public programming from Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm Roger Topp, Director of Exhibits, Design, and Digital Media at the UA Museum of the North, and host for today's episode. In the museum's latest special exhibition, Thinking Made Visible, perception, communication, and invention are explored through nature journals and cartoons, maps and scientific field notes, architectural, art, and exhibit design. Memory and sensory experience are given form by the humble sketchbook. In the course of developing the exhibit, museum staff conducted more than 36 interviews and delighted in following those branching conversations, the cross-cutting themes and stories for a museum exhibit as conversation across conversations. In this episode, we hear from a few of the contributing artists and scientists about intergenerational influence and encouragement, the planting of the seeds for the practice of observation and the visualization of what we see, what we feel. We begin with a conversation with Jillian and Brad Ritchie, daughter and father, archaeologist and architect.
Well, I noticed that in the background of my dad's video here, you have your 4 framed sketches from, what trip is that in the 80s?
The Tachincini.
And so, you know, these are just pen and ink sketches from your field, you know, field sketch trips. And so anyway, I grew up in a house that had these kind of things around and influenced me, I guess, more indirectly than directly, because I don't really remember seeing you sketch or taking, you know, having much free time to do that, you know, when we were kids. We certainly were creative and encouraged to be creative, but I don't specifically remember you doing a lot of drawing or anything. Yeah, at work, exactly. It came to me later in life, and I guess specifically when I was pregnant with my daughter, who's now 4. A lot of my recreational pursuits were, you know, centered around the outdoors, being in the mountains, hiking, skiing, running, and that kind of stuff. And when I was pregnant or when my daughter was very young, I, you know, couldn't quite keep up with my friends in the way that I used to. And it occurred to me to start carrying a sketchbook around. I had art supplies around me my whole life. I just never really had a specific medium. And so I started bringing these sketchbooks into the mountains and into these trips so that I could still tag along in my own way and rest when I needed to rest and pause when I needed to pause, but sort of be able to, you know, reclaim my relationship with the outdoors in those moments where I was having to, like, listen to my body or listen to the newborn. And I thought, well, I can rest and I can make a sketch at this time. You know, like, I'm gonna find my own way to enjoy this. And that's when I really started sketching a lot. And then I found it to be a really interesting way to be connected to the outdoors and sort of in conversation with the outdoors. The special thing about sketchbooks and sketching in the environment is that the environment often plays a role in the sketches. You know, if it's warm, the paint will dry more quickly. If it's rainy, the paint will never dry. You know, I close sketchbooks and mosquitoes get squished inside, or it's windy and the paint goes a certain direction. And I find that painting is more about capturing a feeling and recording an observation to me. And so to have that influence from the environment itself is a bonus, not, you know, an imperfection that I'm trying to avoid. So I really enjoyed that part of it. And I think that it really happened when I was going through that life transition. And I also was spending more time, like, with you, Dad, and Mom, you know, because we had this new baby. And so I think we started sketching more together around that time as well.
This is relatively recently.
Yeah, in the last, you know, 4.5 years.
Yeah. I like to say I'm sort of a lifelong sketcher. So sketching for me was always part of my architectural training and complementing the mechanical drawing that you would learn as an architect. And this sort of freehand sketching was to sort of loosen you up and be a complement or a supplement to the more mechanical architect, the traditional drafting. And even in architecture school, it was actually one of the first times I probably ever made a sketchbook, because often our instructors or professors would require a sketchbook. Didn't matter what you put in it, you just had to fill it up, take it wherever you went, doodle, do something more finished, but just get used to being creative with, you know, sketching. Even when I learned AutoCAD and some of the more sophisticated, you know, CAD programs, I always would start sketching before I would do anything more hardlined. So sketching was a way to communicate ideas, but it was also part of the design process. Sketchbooking came a little bit more later in life, partly influenced by Jillian, and sketching just on little watercolor pads. And Jillian has seen this in my basement. I have clothespins full of dozens and dozens of sketches hung from my little man cave downstairs in our basement, but they weren't always put in books. So Jillian sort of got me encouraged to actually use books, which is easier to carry around, easier to display, easier to, you know, show friends. I would also sketch quite a bit on trips. You know, Jillian and I both have spent a lot of time in the backcountry and taking advantage of living, you know, in the great state of Alaska. And I really enjoyed sketching, partly to get out of evening chores of cooking or making water or putting up the tents. Just having a sketchbook or sketching pads was a way to just reflect on what you were looking at and see if you could sort of capture it in a few, you know, brief strokes. I started off doing a lot of pen and ink work. And I think that my, you know, more formal training as an architect. But then Jillian sort of encouraged me. It was something I always wanted to do, was add a little bit of watercolor washes to these pen and ink black and white sketches I would do. And some many years ago, 8 years ago or so, for Christmas, I got watercolor lessons from Jillian at the local, you know, art shop here in Anchorage. And it was really quite fun. In fact, I took it two or three classes that lasted whatever, 6 weeks or something. And so then I started incorporating more watercolor into what traditionally had been just pen and ink sketches. And the other, I guess, big influence on doing sketchbooks was when our family during COVID started doing sketching, you know, from Ohio, Indiana, Alaska, who else did we have in there? California occasionally, North Carolina, our grandniece. So we did some family props that we would put out there every day. And we had 6 or 8. We had my nephew's mother-in-law. We had my son occasionally, Jillian, my nephew, who was doing sculpture instead of sketching. But we all had our sort of artistic medium that we would use. And that was really, really fun. And you just had sort of a commitment. The prompt was out there. You were expected to produce something. And it didn't matter what it was exactly or how finished it was. It was just the idea of taking 10 minutes out of your busy life. My life wasn't so busy because I think I was mostly retired at the time. But just take a little bit of time to commit to art.
Yeah, and it started with just you and me, Dad. We were just in a group message, and we would exchange prompts and then what we produced that day. And then we're like, oh, we have some creative, you know, people. Our family was hearing about it, and they're like, we want to get in on this too. And so we had like a list of whose turn it was to issue a prompt, and it could be anything you wanted. And then we would just kind of rotate through. And not everyone participated every day, but a lot of people did. And our one my cousin, your nephew, is still doing it every single day, all these, 4 years later. So I guess we inspired him too. Hi, Ingrid. Well, I was going to show this one, actually, because Ingrid, I want to show you this one, too. You might not remember this.
Devil's Thumb.
Yeah, you do. She said Devil's Thumb, which is a feature on the Eastern Alaska Range. And this is from skiing in 2022, so she was not yet three, just about to turn three. And she and I were waiting at the top of a mountain that we climbed, skinned up on our backcountry skis with her in the backpack, and my husband was doing a lap while we rested at the top and made a little sketch, and she put down some lines and some colors first, and then I filled in around that. So this was one of our first collaborative pieces.
So her watercolor there on the left-hand side.
Yeah. And then these
line, the line work.
Yeah, yeah, she's into the line work too, the pencil. but I love how, I mean, this is like exactly my memory of the day. And this is, you know, almost exactly 2 years ago. And she can say, oh, this is Devil's Thumb. And like, mm-hmm. I've never showed her this sketchbook. But she, I guess, can remember it.
Well, that's a question that comes up a lot, and we talk to many artists about, is the advantage of sketching in a space and what they remember in the moments that they were actively sketching.
Mm-hmm. And we've skied this line and this mountain, you know, a dozen times over the years, and a couple times with her. But like, I vividly remember this specific time, and because of the sketch, because we took the time to sit and observe and mm-hmm. have a snack and share some supplies together. Clearly, Ingrid and I share supplies, and now it's even, I try to carry an extra set, and she's like, nope, I want this one, I want to go in this book, like, mm-hmm. we're still fully collaborating, but it's fun to have, like, this was on a trip, and a friend was like, oh, can I give it a shot?
Someone's
and
first.
I said, okay, yeah, of course.
when did you begin sketching, drawing? When was art your future?
I don't remember.
When you were a kid?
Because it was all the time. I'm always doodling. Always doodling.
This is Jamie Smith, cartoonist and UAF assistant professor.
In my school notebooks, on the desks, in the textbooks, was one, on the bathroom walls, was one of those. Got always compulsively doodling. I always, whenever I'm in a meeting, anywhere, I will always be doodling and sketching. Maybe it's a safe place to me and I mentally retreat into it, or as a way for me to focus my observation, irony being that I'm not, I look like I'm not, but I actually am, I'm paying attention. The comics, I don't know how deep of a dive you want to go. My father was a high school teacher in English, Latin, and French, and he used foreign language editions of comics. He was way ahead of the curve now as far as fostering a lifelong love of literacy. I'm lucky to have been around long enough to see the paradigm shift of, like, put that away, or they grab the comic because it'll rot your brain. That's bad for you. Versus now, your savvy teacher would be like, oh, yeah, please, no, here, I'll give you another graphic novel. As soon as they find something, you know, that might be the hook that sells it.
Sounds very Neil Gaiman, right? Read anything.
Exactly. Yeah. So, an irony of ironies. Now we have rock stars in the comics industry that writers have, some of them almost as much status as the artists do, if not more. Neil Gaiman being the main example. Alan Moore would be another. Watchmen and V for Vendetta and things like that. He also has a lot of stuff adapted. So writers are now almost as popular, can be as big of a draw as the artist on it. So back to my dad would leave copies. I would say the first comics I ever saw were Asterix the Gaul, one of the three most universally recognized comics in the world, the other being Karl Barks, Donald Duck, and then Tintin. But Asterix is in, I can't even remember, 30, 40 different languages.
Began in French?
Oh, yeah. So he had Latin and Latin too. Okay. So, so even though I was at the age where I was having trouble, I was struggling with English. I was looking at these and the drawings were so good. Pantomime were so well drawn that I could come up with my own stories. And they almost told their own stories just looking at the pictures, even if I didn't read the words yet. And that planted the seed for me. And then I didn't return to comics until high school, where I flunked art classes and ultimately dropped out in my senior year. I was a bad student. I was a poor student. That's all there is to it. But in high school was where I rediscovered a love of comics. I had plateaued and basically aged out of them, I guess you could say, some of the traditional comic books. But then in high school, I discovered in the 80s, early 80s, underground comics, which don't exist anymore because everything is above ground. But underground comics, I started, there was a series in particular called Slow Death. It was an anthologized series from all these different artists. Fun topics like nuclear war, nuclear holocaust, endangered species, cancer, you know, fun topics like that. But I opened my eyes that there were actually serious artists that were dealing with serious topics, not the funny ha-ha and not the goofy superhero stuff. It was actually real stuff. And that started me down a path of degradation and sin. No, just kidding. But that was where a light went on, and I started doing my comics. Took a markedly different underground sex, drugs, violence, all that stuff that wasn't in the normal stuff. And then that petered out again, but I was still making my own comic books all the way. From when I was a kid, I was making my own stupid stuff. And my mom saved it all, and I was like, wow, I was really trying to do comics. And I still am. You know, I still am. So,
What's your take home? What's your take home for students in terms of here's why you should do comics, here's why you should sketch, just in a word, people take whole classes from you, but if people want to get 50 words from you on why this is a good thing and you should explore it.
Sketching, for all the reasons that I told you, it's fostering that connection, meditative process. Eventually, when you're done with my class, you won't have time to meditate while you're doing it. But as an activity, artistic or psychological, emotional, all for all those reasons. So that's a different process. The cartooning, the comics, when you look at the table that I have, the breadth and depth of all the different styles, all the stories, it's really expanded. It's not your grandpa's comics. It is one of the most powerful and uniquely effective ways to tell a story. That's what they go after first while you're seeing books being banned. Arkansas, actually, they've just weighed in 2 days ago. They've stopped the law that was going to criminalize librarians for having books on their shelves. That passed, but their Supreme Court said, no, this is a little bit probably too fascistic, that's my word. But they go after that because it's so powerful. Ask any librarian. And what's the most popular? I gave a workshop, a two-hour workshop out at the North Pole Library a few weeks ago for their summer reading program. Came out, 35, 40 kids in the room. It was really popular. It went really well. And we took a walk over. You know, I was like, when we were done with the hosting library, I was like, hey, take us to where the graphic novels are. So, you know, we all as a group went there. You know, and I remember taking a picture of this student that was on their knees with a pile of books, and they were just by themselves in the stacks. And I was like, that's what it's all about. It's like, I got to read this so I can find out if it's worth my time to take it home and read it. Mm-hmm. I know, understand that exactly. And you ask any librarian, they're popular, which isn't necessarily, you know, a good thing. Right? Look at movies and music and food and whatever. But it's huge. Hugely popular. I'm a single child. And my mother was a reference librarian, and my father managed B. Dalton Booksellers at the time. He was a regional manager, and he also had his own used bookstores, the original used bookstores. No internet, no coffee machine, just mold that smell of books and piles everywhere. So that was how I was brought up. It was not rude for the three of us to sit around the dinner table reading while we're eating. That was, what a mind-blowing for other people. I was like, oh, that was considered rude to read. I mean, I can understand because now with cell phones, how many people, you know, are doing that while they're eating or reading or anything. I can, but kind of this weird disconnect. I was brought up with books, so that's my in, that's my window.
Branch number two, art and science. Moments from seven of the three dozen conversations that frame the exhibit. These interviews were conducted by myself and Tamara Martz, our exhibit's lead designer. We begin with artist Roseanne Hansen.
I've been keeping a field notebook, probably ostensibly since I was 8 years old, when my father built me a weather station when I was little. And every day at 4 o'clock, he gave me a notebook and I would go out, run out and check the weather. And this is back in the day when you wrote everything down. There was no computers that did anything for you. So I would go out and write the temperature, the wind speed, the barometric pressure and all that. And I think that started my passion for recording nature, science, observation. Later, I started in college studying ecology and evolutionary biology. And I adopted the Grinnell method of scientific note-taking, which was still taught at that time. Grinnell was the first curator of the Museum of Vertebrate Ecology at Berkeley in California. So he set the standard in the 20s for scientific note-taking, which didn't really include sketching, but I have, you know, 30 years of very extensive field notes from my work as a scientist, a conservationist, and a few sketches, just a little stick figures and things. Mm-hmm. But about 10 years ago, I decided to teach myself the drawing part because I saw huge value in, and also the beauty of sketching and adding context to what I was learning scientifically. So I'm totally self-taught. Mm-hmm. I was inspired by Claire Walker Leslie, by John Muir Laws, who was actually a student of Claire Walker Leslie's, Hannah Hinchman, also a teacher of John Muir Laws. Jack Laws, John Muir Laws, is now kind of carrying the torch forward. But I was very inspired by the combination they used of beauty sketches and still science notes, which is what nature journaling is.
I didn't realize it was, that seems far more recent. I sort of had built up this big, long history of sketching, and so it sounds like the sort of the focus on the sketching part is more...
For myself, actually, the sketching and keeping artistic field notes and sketch notebooks, field notebooks, goes back hundreds of years in England. And the United Kingdom, actually, all of the colonies. It was quite a huge thing in the Victorian era. And of course, scientists didn't have cameras early on. So the classical education, everyone was taught sketching watercolor. So Darwin, his notebooks have quite a lot of sketches. Then you have people like Beatrix Potter, who was both a mycologist, a scientist, a published scientist, but also she had her art notebooks. And then, of course, her stories about the bunnies.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Yes, okay. She was one of the foremost scientists of her time. She wasn't immediately recognized as a woman. At the time, women were not just recognized.
If you're in an environment that you've spent a lot of time in, is there ever a point that you go out there and be like, okay, I want to look at something, but I don't know, I've seen everything. I don't think there is. There's always new stuff, right? But
good question.
A go-to to get you started when you're in that moment of like, I don't know what to draw, or I don't know what to look at?
You could say that might be the case for me in the Sonoran Desert where I grew up. And yes, I am very familiar with it. But there is never a time I am out in nature. The Sonoran Desert, here's a good example. We ran a week-long field arts program in the Sonoran Desert in April. And no, I learned something every single time, because that's what nature journaling encourages you to do, is to notice and to look for things.
I have always loved doing art ever since I was very little. I was born in Belgium and it's very rainy there, so I spent a lot of time drawing.
Artist Kristen Link.
And so that's always kind of been something that I knew that I enjoyed doing and spent a lot of time doing. And I also always loved science. So people, when I was growing up, were like, oh, you should look in, you should be a science illustrator and look into that. But I didn't know what that meant. And I pictured like the inside of an ear poster that you have in a doctor's office. And I was like, yeah, I don't really want to do that. So I never really like thought that made sense. I also never, I don't feel like a lot of people said like that being, an, I didn't grow up with the impression that being an artist was like a good solid career choice. But I always loved doing art and I always loved studying science. And I continued to pursue both of those things through university. I decided to do a art thesis for my studio art degree. I also did a degree in conservation biology, but I loved doing art, so I kept following the things that I liked doing and was taking all of these biology classes where I had to spend a lot of time looking at and memorizing specimens so that I could identify like what bird or what invertebrate that was. And I was spending so much time looking at these things that then I started drawing them, and I found that I really loved that connection between drawing from observation. It allowed me to get to a level of specificity that I just really enjoyed, like that detail.
So it was almost an organic shift for you, combining the two. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, this is what I'm going to do.
I loved nature, I loved art, I loved science. I knew that I enjoyed those things, but I didn't know how to combine them until all of a sudden, like one day I started doing it, and I didn't think I even liked that kind of, like, I didn't think drawing would be the thing that I picked of all the art mediums. But yeah, it was the thing that I got the most out of, I guess, or kind of, I love kind of thinking about the way things are structured or formed. I kind of graduated from college knowing that I liked that, but I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, and finally looked up science illustration programs and found out that science illustration is so much more than medical illustration, and that it can include like explaining ecology and what it's like to be a person in the environment, and that there's a lot of work for people doing that, and that kind of fit into my interests of outdoor education and biology and ecology. So I applied to a science illustration program and was accepted. And so I did a year-long certificate program at CSU Monterey Bay. And one of the first classes in the first semester was field sketching. And so I've always done art outside, or like enjoyed doing art outside. My grandmother, who taught me a lot of art, was a watercolor painter, and she did a lot of plein air painting with us. Mm-hmm. But that was the first time that it kind of like combined everything I love into this one class and was like, this is a thing, you know, that you can do, or we did it as a way of like a tool for science illustration and kind of improving our sketching and drawing. Mm-hmm. But that class was such a big like light bulb for me, and I was like, oh, I want to teach this to people and share it with people.
When I make art, I want every piece of art I make to be as finished and as good as I can make it, as perfect as I can make it, as near to perfect as I can make it.
Artist Kessler Woodward.
When I was in undergraduate school, I think a lot of this comes from not having been into art when I was growing up. If anybody had told me when I was a senior in high school that I'd be an artist, I'd not only have been surprised, I'd be highly offended. I was a math and science nerd, and I was really into math and science, and was totally focused on that. And then I went off to college. I fell in love with an art major. I went to an art class, and I fell under not only her spell, but the spell of a painting teacher who became my mentor.
In school, I always excelled when I took notes because that would help me remember. Like the audit, like I'm not an auditory learner. Mm-hmm. So if I can go back and visually look at what I've learned, I can aid in memorizing it.
Artist and UAF adjunct professor, Summer Hom.
I have never had a dedicated sketchbook practice. That's a part of what I'm going to be doing in Italy. That is my goal, is to draw every single day.
Okay.
One, at least once a day in Italy. And I have the same objective for my kids. I'm treating it kind of as a very informal residency, where that trip is about making that space for drawing. And I hope to be prolific, because I think that that is so important for an artist, you know, especially when you don't quite have a direction, or maybe you're between a bunch of different directions, is to just make as much as you can or draw as much as you can.
Yeah.
And if I'm teaching about perspective, for instance, I don't know, like I want to have a solid grasp. I want to know exactly what to do, the tips, the tricks, the, mm-hmm. you know, and I need to be able to spend the time working that out,
right?
You know, visually,
right?
And working on it. And yeah, I just kind of feel like I have not had the opportunity to have that time yet. Mm-hmm. So making space for that is one of my goals for this next coming year. And it's funny too, because I tried to do that when we went on our trip to Tucson this last year, and we did draw a little bit and the kids drew a little bit. And, you know, we had a really fun time, like took materials, pencils, color pencils out on some hikes. And mm-hmm. I think, this is my daughter's. We did the same. Oh, see, I can't even tell because I bought these sketchbooks to Mara, and then my kids were like, I want that one. And then one was like, no, I want that one. And I was like, okay, guys, well, which one's for me? And they're like, the one with the gray paper. And I was like, no. And then, and I'm like, okay, everybody's sharing. We're all going to share. And so these sketchbooks I had high hopes for, and then suddenly they didn't become just my sketchbooks. They uh-huh. became my kids' sketchbooks too, which makes me feel interrupted when I don't get my own
space.
Yep. I don't even get my own space in this sketchbook.
Yeah.
I have to share my space with my kids. Like I took this up in onto the organ pipe in the saguaros and was super excited about these like gesture cactus drawings. And then my son was like, I want to draw. And then I had to give my materials over to him, and which was fine, but like an exercise in patience and just another daily example of how like my needs for draw, like even when it comes to something simple like drawing, get shelved.
Yeah.
And then I lost my, you know, I lost my groove on that.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
I grew up, you know, doing art. I had a really fantastic teacher in high school, had 4 years of art. And then I did my undergraduate and I kind of put it away for a while, focused on my studies and said, I'll put that away.
Nicole Webster, artist and UAF oceanography PhD student.
And then after I graduated my undergraduate, I was an AmeriCorps member at the Prince William Sound Science Center in Cordova. So basically that meant day to day I was an environmental educator. And when the pandemic hit, I had a really great mentor there, and she said, you need a project to work on during this pandemic when we can't talk with the kids and go into the schools. And she's like, you're always doodling on the corners of papers. Like, is there some way we can integrate that into environmental education? And so I kind of dug into what's called the nature journaling movement, and got a couple books and started practicing, and ended up teaching a year-long course in high school, or to the Cordova high schoolers, all about nature journaling, and it just spiraled from there. So I was in Cordova for 3 years, and during my last summer in Cordova, Seth asked me to come on the summer cruise for the LTER program. And so I was able to take a little bit of time off from my job in Cordova, went on this cruise and I said, you know, I really like this nature journaling thing. It's keeping me calm, sane, helping me understand everything. And so I just kind of, you know, kept to the side and did it on my own time on the cruise. And eventually Seth was like, what are you doing? And I said, this is how I process information. This is how I take notes on this information. And he's like, we should do something with that. So it kind of expanded from there.
Excellent. And then the PhD program came out of that?
No, I actually signed on to do the PhD program before. Okay. Yeah, it wasn't something I really, you know, I didn't have a presence in the art spaces or online with my work at that point. It was just kind of my own personal journals. But Seth was receptive to it, as was the rest of my committee. And so I've been integrating it here and there into my work since then.
I always tell people it started with I blame my parents.
Artist Colleen Furman-Thomas.
They were just so encouraging, like, which is funny if you're like totally practical people, like they were just so practical, like, this is what you need to do this and this to like take care of yourself. But look at you're going to be an artist when you grow up. So it's totally their fault.
It's brilliant. So they're not, neither are artistic?
They're really creative.
Okay.
Yeah, my mom is, I think she's very artistic, but she doesn't really like, she was a teacher. She could like draw, she did beadwork. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you do beadwork, you draw out the designs and she would draw pictures for us when we were a kid and stuff. And she could just like whip out things freehand and be like, here you go. And she's that beautiful penmanship and she's very like, you know, teachers are so creative.
Yeah.
And she's always sewing, and which is what I started working with these. So they're creative. And my dad is more analytical, but he does like, so his version of creative things is different, but really interesting. Like he's the one who, all my bones and stuff are from him. He got mm-hmm. into like, he got into cleaning bones and putting skulls back together, and which totally, and I have, he made some really beautiful ones, but they're upstairs because they're so pretty. but yeah, his creative is more like the practical, so, but not anything like painting or anything like that.
Sure.
But I made this like, I would boss my sisters and brothers around.
And are you the oldest?
I'm the oldest. I had this art class in the backyard and I told them like how they're going to make this thing. And we had like these little blocks of wood that I thought were super cool because they're like weathered. And I told like all these, my cousins, because I grew up in Fort Yukon. So I gave them like these little pine cones. Spruce cones, we're going to glue them on here. And so we glued it on there and I like gave it to my dad. I was like, we made this in my class. And my dad was like, this is so amazing. Like he just loved it. And he like put it on the front porch. He's like, look what Colleen made. And like, I don't know how, I must have been like Meadow's age, 7 or 8 or something. And he's like, I'm going to get your mom. And he was like, brought her out. My sister had torn it all apart. Because she was mad at how much he liked it. But I liked the, like, you know, putting, like, all these elements together. I love to tell that story to make my sister upset.
Like, you're never going to let me forget that one, are you?
I love that sculpture you ruined.
Yes, my favorite. It was my best work. Yeah.
I never found another stump like that I could work with. Mm-hmm.
It was a one of a kind.
Yeah. Awesome. So that's when it started. Yeah. They're all very encouraging, my family, which is very, yeah. I don't know if all artists experience that. I hope they do. Yeah, because, like, the community that I grew up in and, like, my family was always like, Colleen's an artist. What is she making? She'll make you something. You know? Sometimes I look at the stuff, I'm like, look what's hanging on your wall. You love me a lot.
Branch number 3, 3 generations. From a conversation with artist and science illustrator, Mary B. Kaufman.
Very often I will take a journal, and whether I'm doing a group show or doing a solo show, I maintain a chronologically based journal and just put ideas in it, and some morph into other areas that are never used, but it gives me something to go back to. My father also maintained scientific journals, you know, 8.5 by 11, 25 linen pages for 60 years. And I grew up with that. And he also did art in his stuff. So from the age of 13, I started putting together little journals. And over the years, I mean, they're all sorts of sizes. I've got hundreds of these things, right? And some of them just have little sketches in them. And some of them are more full of journeys that I've taken. I was married to a wildlife photographer, and we would travel around the world. And so I've got just journal after journal of all this stuff from all over the world. Because you're sitting there for long periods of time waiting for an animal to calm down or do its thing. So I'm sitting there, you know, sketching and that
quiet,
sort of thing.
Quietly, yeah.
Yes, yes. So that's kind of how that all came about. And when I've gotten involved in these art projects, it's just been very useful to me to put them all in one journal so that I can figure out what it is I want to do. It becomes snippets of writing that people have done that I, you know, it's like a collage work as well as my ideas, both visual and in terms of text. It's very helpful. I would go out in the field with my father and, you know, and we'd sketch plants, that sort of thing, or come back. And I would go, he was a curator for the Natural History Museum in the University of Kansas. And so I'd go into the museum and hang out after school and, you know, get to go in the diorama and took some, I didn't study art, but I took a class in scientific illustration mm-hmm. at the University of Kansas. And so I did a little bit of that. When I came to Alaska, I had been working as a geologist. And back in the day, I would use Letrisets. And I would have these huge sheets. And I would do the artwork. I would do all the, I'd have these huge maps that I'd be working on. And I did everything by hand. And you'd talk to the geologists, and because I did art, I ended up, you know, being the illustrator. But you'd talk about different concepts in structural geology, and I worked with a guy named Tommy Thompson out of Boulder who taught structural geology and global tectonics all around the world. And so it was really fun. So we did the Tethys and, you know, the North Sea and the margins of the Himalaya. I ended up traveling to Asia with that one, and it all kind of came out of working with Tommy Thompson and doing all these amazing maps by hand, you know. And then I got involved in something called paleospastic reconstruction. Basically, when you have all these folded and faulted and squished rocks, like in the Rocky Mountains, you take them and you stretch them out and lay them flat to where they originally were deposited.
All right, see it.
Yeah, so all the, yeah. And you do that, you know, by hand with, you know, measuring the geometries. And now it's, you know, all done digitally. And so it was interesting because once, you know, computers got in and the digital aspects kind of took over the geometries, I kind of like backed off of geology almost completely, came up to Alaska and ended up being a guide. It's like, so, yeah, and kind of went back to my roots. Mm-hmm. I ran the guiding program for a place called the Kantishna Roadhouse in Denali National Park, and I put together pamphlets about different aspects of the backyard botany and, you know, walking the road up to Wonder Lake and gold mining and a variety of things, you know, that people, walking guides that they could take out. And I illustrated all that sort of stuff, but also wrote some of the text in conjunction with other people like Carolyn Parker. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't all me sort of thing. So
early on, you visited the museum your father was at to and did some drawing, illustrating there, learning how to do studies and that.
Yeah, yeah.
And more recently with the IOTOC, you worked with Derek and the Beatles from our collection here, or?
Yeah. Well, it's a whole smattering of things, but I live south of Cantwell, and when the spruce bark beetle hit our area, you know, in order to just kind of wrap my soul around it, I started doing art about it. And I started, you know, capturing these little beetles, and I'd put them on a piece of paper and I'd video them walking around, and then I'd, you know, sketch from that. Or I used the gallery shapes a lot in my artwork, that sort of thing. And that's I mean, I have a whole, that's how I got involved in the IOTC, because I just needed a, you know, way to move that idea forward, and the IOTC ended up to be a really good way for me to do that. I internalize a lot, so getting it out on paper, making it visible to myself, and then turning the page and moving on to the next day chronologically, you know, and then I put, you know, that, and it allows me to take a deep breath. So it's something that I do for myself, for sure. When he was very young, he started doing journals, and I'm sure that's because his father did that as well, and he produced these beautiful, I have one, most of them are at the archives at BYU because he got his master's, PhD there, and so it went there, and he was born and raised in Provo. But earlier on, his dad wrote stories, and more richly embellished as a story about trips that he did. He guided with a fellow by the name of Inglesby, who was with Powell on the Colorado trips, and my grandfather took horses and guided for them, and he did trips where he went out, and he wrote the stories about them, all hand-typed into these little books, embellished with photos of like 20, you know, cougars lined up, or, you know, all these deer or rabbits or whatever, you know, and then was telling the story about going on these trips. So my father, I'm sure, got, you know, started writing in conjunction with that. And they did things. My grandfather collected minerals. He collected bird's egg. There are all these great pictures of my father hanging off of cliffs to try to get bird's eggs. And a lot of that stuff actually went to the Smithsonian. But yeah, he had all sorts of different shaped field notebooks, but it all, every night, went into his 8.5 by 11 linen, beautifully cursive writing, annotated drawings. And that's what I grew up with. And so I started journaling when I was working, but mine was much more chaotic. It's never been this pretty. I mean, this is so inconsistent.
Do you think you adopted your practice a little bit influenced by him, as he was influenced by his father?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd go on vacation, and he'd be sitting there, you know, finishing off his notes every night. I mean, he'd take me out in the field no matter where we were, and I'd be carrying a little pack filled with mousetraps, you know, the museum mousetraps, and we'd set up a line of traps, and then he'd go out the next morning, we'd collect, he'd come back and do his museum mounts in the trailer that we had, and then every night he would write in his journal. And so, you know, you're kind of sitting there, so I'd be sitting there in my little diary or whatever, you know, drawing pictures and writing stuff. And later on, I went through a phase where I actually used the same size journal, and I still have some of those, but as I've gotten more involved in my artistic side, I guess, my visual painting and drawing side, it's turned into, I do a lot more sketches, you know, my writing is much more fluid. But so it's three generations of doing that.
A heartfelt thank you for all the conversations that went into making this exhibition. And appearing in order in this episode, Jillian Ritchie, Brad Ritchie, Ingrid Ritchie, Jamie Smith, Roseanne Hansen, Kristen Link, Kesla Woodward, Summer Hom, Nicole Webster, Colleen Furman Thomas, and Mary B. Kaufman. Special thanks to UAMN design lead Tamara Martz for helping to plan and conduct these interviews. We're looking forward to telling many more stories discovered through the creation of this exhibit. Keep a lookout for future episodes. The exhibit, Thinking Made Visible, runs through January 5th, 2025, in the museum's Special Exhibits Gallery. The More You Look is a production of the UA Museum of the North on the campus of the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the ancestral lands of the Dene people of the lower Tanana River. UAMN illuminates the natural history and cultural heritage of Alaska and the North through collections, research, education, and partnerships, and by creating a singular museum experience that honors diverse knowledge and a respect for the land and its peoples. Thank you for listening. The More You Look is broadcast on KOAC-FM radio and available anywhere podcasts are found. Please subscribe and share and rate the program. This helps other listeners discover more about not only the work of this museum, but museums throughout the world. The more you look, the more you find.